Well, to Moss.
Good evening, Raymond.
I need a drink after that.
Well, I think Tam O'Shanter.
Mm. I'm just tempted to say, like, why didn't he write it for bagpipes? It sort of wails away like mad there. But, you know, okay, if it was only 8 minutes.
It was a raucous first half. I mean, the whole thing was raucous. But, yeah, it's a very strange piece. I don't think it's one of the high watermarks of European classical civilization. Mm-hmm. Possibly the best thing involving a bagpipe in a classical frame. How about that? But I don't think we can push him up there with Mendelssohn and Beethoven. It's a very interesting piece. It's actually a very noisy piece. I mean, yeah. I don't know, is that technical musical criticism to say it's a terrible loud clatter of a thing?
At times there, he manages to make an orchestra sound like a set of bagpipes, which is some achievement. Wasn't he much better known, really? Wasn't his high watermark was film composition?
Yeah, Bridge Over the River Kwai.
Bridge on the River Kwai.
All right, okay. On. I bow to your knowledge, sir. Bow to your knowledge.
Well, at least you got the river right.
Thank you very much. And what I do know is that he didn't write the Colonel Bogey's March. So he didn't write the famous march.
Doo-doo.
That was not it. Let's not do this. There are people here interested in music,
yes,
Raymond.
I see an usher coming over.
Yes, calm down. So he didn't write that. That was a fellow called Lieutenant J.L. Ricketts.
J.L. Ricketts.
And he only revealed himself later on because he was in the army when he wrote it. And so he kept it all secret. Malcolm Arnold did compose the Bridge on the River Kwai march, which is a very important part of the actual film itself. But he, you know, he was a very significant film composer. And he even did, there's a connection with Walton, because he actually really, I mean, some people say he held the great man's hand while he wrote the score for the Battle of Britain in 1969.
Oh, right.
Walton was a great friend of Arnold's, and he tried to help him along, and he brought together the strands. You can hear our friend Malcolm Arnold any evening, if you're listening to Rick Stein's shows, because the Cornish Dance is the theme tune for that show. He's there. He has a foothold in our evening's listening.
But my breath was also taken away for an entirely positive reason with the Mendelssohn. I mean, that to me, it's one of those works which is part of the standard repertoire. There's no question about that. But it's a magnificent piece of work. It's not middle of the road in that sense at all. No. Fantastic piece of work. Lots of innovation there, Tomás, in that work. It was definitely moving on from the classical era into the romantic era. For instance, the soloist comes in right at the very beginning, which is quite unusual, or was unusual, where typically the orchestra would introduce the theme and so forth, and the soloist would come in and develop it and answer it. But the soloist jumps straight in at the very beginning there. Another new thing was that at the end of the first movement, the soloist plays a bassoon note. A bassoon carries from the first into the second movement without any break whatsoever. And then between second and third movement, you have the soloist playing a bridging piece, they call it, where, again, there's no silence. There's no silence because Mendelssohn was trying to stop the audience clapping between movements, which we don't do now, typically. I always sit on my hands until someone else starts clapping, so I know exactly what to get it right.
I can see that of an evening. I can see that.
So this was a way of trying to... But magnificent piece. Magnificent piece.
It's fantastic. But again, why is it that people think he's light? Why is Mendelssohn light?
I think, again, we come back to we've often mentioned this, but numerous composers, of course, is he died young. He was 38 when he died. His last major work was that violin concerto. And, of course, you look and you say, that's what he was capable of doing then. What might the next 20 years have held? So perhaps that's why he's as you say, on the lighter, in public memory or perception, he's in on the lighter side of things. Also, maybe the idea that he was a child prodigy. He was a dazzling talent in the same way as Mozart was. And maybe that fixed an impression in the public psyche, the public mind, and they never sort of accorded him any more heavyweight status, perhaps.
Goethe had seen both Mozart as a prodigy, child prodigy, and he'd seen Mendelssohn as a child prodigy. And so you have, you know, this great figure in sort of German culture is identifying the two of them as, you know, lovely, you know, wonderful little players, great technical little players.
What was it? Wasn't it the critic H.L. Mencken said something to the effect that if Mendelssohn missed true genius, it was only by a hair's breadth. There was a fantastic rating of him by serious commentators.
All the time. I mean, the problem was there's this gap period, and it's a troubling gap period. So after his death, we do find that he's being very well looked after. And by the time you get round to the sort of even the 1880s, we have sponsorship of people trying to get money together to build a monument on his behalf. And eventually they do. They succeed. So in the 1890s, they get a beautiful statue put up in Leipzig in front of the concert hall. But then by 1936, the mood in Germany had swung very considerably away from an open, the crucible of great culture that Germany had become throughout the 19th century. And you get this false sense or a sense of Germanic sort of culture that didn't embrace their Jewish heritage.
Yes.
And he was part of that. And he was then identified with that, with the outsider or the degenerate art, I think, as they called it, under the Nazi regime. And the monument was pulled down, and it didn't get put back up until 2008.
That long to acknowledge their mistake.
That's a long time
to get that
monument back up. But it's up now. It's back up. Now, obviously, we'd have to say that of course, Leipzig was in for when we think back a bit now, probably people won't even remember. It was the Democratic German Republic. So Leipzig was in the DDR, and they had other plans rather than doing that. But, here's, I suppose you can say, the first opportunity of a united Germany.
Yeah.
One of their acts there is to restore Mendelssohn monumentally and physically to Leipzig.
I suppose Wagner probably had something to say about Mendelssohn, did he?
Oh, there's thin ice to be skating on. There's thin ice.
Okay, I won't push you out there tomorrow.
I mean, he did. I think, there's a troubling part to Wagner. And there's a troubling part to a lot of, everything that went on at that point in time. And he did write some very unpleasant things about Mendelssohn and about Mendelssohn's capabilities. And I think that the least we can say, we're not suggesting for a minute that Wagner was a Nazi or anything like it, but that the unpleasantness and the slightly unfortunate way in which he phrased a lot of his negativity gave credence and weight to those Nazis who came afterwards and decided to utilize his good name to do this.
And they adopted him.
Yes.
I mean, they literally adopted him. He was their national composer almost at that, even though they, obviously himself and Hitler weren't contemporaries. But the Bayreuth Festival every year was an incredible thing, a big Nazi fest almost. And the Wagner family, his descendants, well, they, a bit of mud would have stuck there now if anyone was anyone cared to throw it.
They did not have a good war. Wagner wrote, he wrote a paper on the contribution of Jewish culture to music, which was not a very positive view.
Yeah. It's just, you mentioned as well there, Tomás, that, the crucible of creative genius in Germany in the 19th century. Wasn't it such a... I mean, just think of, we can go way back if you wanted to Bach, you can come through Beethoven, who we'll be talking about shortly, and then Wagner and others, and to think of the barbarity that followed from that nation that contributed so much, just so much creative genius there, and then this, right at the other, out at the other end of the spectrum, this barbarity,
It always astounds me, and I think when thinking about Mendelssohn, listening to that, listening to the beautiful violin concerto, and to me it's a high watermark of European classical culture, that very piece. And again, what we're, coming up now with Beethoven, obviously. So these are two peaks of culture, and yet right in the center of that peak, there's, as we're listening to it, we're back projecting. It could have had nothing like this could have been imagined by either Mendelssohn or Wagner. But you're back projecting and you're feeling, there's a terrible sorrow for knowing what's coming next.
Beethoven, for me, one of the great pillars. I mean, he's right up there in Western civilization. Shakespeare, Isaac Newton, J.S. Bach, of course, whoever, he's right up there with them. And one thing I've always stuck in my mind, I read about him once, was that in any musical form in which he worked, he radically transformed it. And I always think that's a sign of like a real genius, is that there are many, many artists working in their own genre or whatever, but principally they might be working with the handed down precepts. Whereas anything he took, he transformed. So, for instance, most memorably, or most publicly, I suppose, the symphonies. But just leaving them for a second, Tomás, I mean, The piano sonatas are considered to be like 32 piano sonatas, a fantastic corpus of work. The string quartets, particularly the late string quartets, people say things about some of the late string quartets. I can think, for instance, the Große Fugue is one of them. It's still contemporary. It has a contemporary sound, a slightly edgy sound. I mean, the Große Fugue, I must have listened to it 6 or 8 times before I got to like it, you know? So anything he touched, he seemed to turn to gold. And as I say, I mean, the 9 symphonies for me, they stand beside Shakespeare's tragedies, whatever like you like to call a Rembrandt great work, whatever it might be. And it's interesting that the 7th, I often thought to myself, the 7th, you know, if you were to point to one piece of music that was typically Beethoven-esque, it could possibly be the 7th. There could be others as well, but it holds a special place for me because I remember I was about the age of 14 and I came across, in my parents' house at home, I came across a vinyl LP. We know what they are now because they're coming back into fashion. I came across a Deutsche Grammophon, Herbert von Karajan, Berlin Philharmonic recording, and I can still see the photograph on the front, you know, Karajan, arm outstretched imperiously over the orchestra, you know. I reckon, you know, the day he was born, he was probably bossing the midwife around. I think he was imperious right from the very beginning, you know. But this was a fantastic, this was the Damascene piece of music for me. Absolutely, you know, I was hooked after that. Listened to it many, many times. And then, of course, listened to other symphonies as well. The 9th, of course. It's funny, it's nearly all the odd-numbered symphonies. 3, 5, 7, 9, and 6 would be the big Beethoven symphonies. And the 3rd symphony is interesting as well, because that's the one. His 1st and 2nd symphonies are pretty much written within the form as it then was. The 3rd symphony moved things on. That was the one where he stretched the whole, what a symphony stood for. And he dedicated it to Napoleon, because he saw Napoleon. At that time, there was the whole thing was, you know, the French Revolution was only a few years prior to that. But he dedicated it to Napoleon. And of course, in 1805, Napoleon declared himself emperor. And this ran contrary to all of Beethoven's principles, and he tore out the dedication page for the Eroica Symphony, you know. But we're here to talk about the 7th.
1813, it was the Live Aid of its day.
The Live Aid?
The premiere was the Live Aid of its day. It was a huge event. It was, you know, a very big organisation. They got every single one of the best players in Europe, and they brought them to Vienna, and they were all there. The finest violinists, the best bassoonist, everyone was present for this. It was a huge gala event. They had, you know, there was a very large program.
Ladies and gentlemen, all doors will close in 5 minutes. We request that you take your seats in the auditorium. All doors will close in 5 minutes.
And it was all in aid of the Allied powers. So it was for soldiers, wounded, fighting Napoleon. So he'd gone from writing on his behalf to sponsoring a very large concert, being the centrepiece of a very large concert, was making money for the Allies, essentially. And it was a wild and raucous evening, a wild and raucous performance. And he was, you know, you'll see every review that you'll ever read of it has, I think it was the first time people thought, I wonder, is he all there? Because there was a lot of jumping around. There was a lot of heavy activity. And I'd have to say, I was thinking about what you're saying there about the Deutsche Grammophon record. Had the same one. Parents had the same one. And there's the, you know, the huge, that vision of Karajan. That's, to me, that's, you know, that's romantic music, is this huge figure. And of course, Penguin Books did the same thing, you know, the Penguin classics in the sort of 70s, when they switched to having these heavy covers, you know, very, very figurative covers of what was going on inside. They defined a generation, what was happening inside the book. And I think, you know, certainly images of classical music coming out of Deutsche Grammophon. I don't think we give enough credit to people like and companies like Deutsche Grammophon.
Yeah, they certainly did a huge, as you say, for people like of our age.
Yeah, young people like ourselves.
They defined it for it. Those, you remember that the yellow masthead, a standard right across all the records. And of course, as you say, I mean, every second one seemed to feature Karajan on the front. Yes. With the Berlin Philharmonic. He was a fascinating character. He really was imperious. You know, they kept a suite permanently for him at the Adlon Hotel in Berlin. And he flew his own plane. You know, he flew his own plane. Oh, yeah, he flew his own private plane around. So he flew around Europe, you know, Salzburg Festival, all this sort of thing. But he knew he was God anyway. Maybe not sure anybody else did. Beethoven did conduct that first performance,
yes,
didn't he?
Yes, yeah, he did. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But there were worries. I mean, I think he began to feel he was going deaf around 1800, something like that. So by 1813, it was seriously progressed. And one of the most interesting, apparently interesting sources for serious study of Beethoven are what they called his conversation books, where he, it was like a copybook, and you know, if I was Beethoven, I'd hand you the book, you'd write down what you wanted to say to me, I'd come back. And these survive, the conversation books survive, and they're a really serious part. 1813, he still was able to hear okay, but it was getting very difficult. And of course, that then, imagine, just imagine the torture for somebody whose entire being and life is aural, to lose out on sound. It just must have been horrific for him. And they're saying that, you know, some of those late works, I mentioned the late string quartets, I mean, there's an edge there. Maybe this is a man who's right on the brink, I mean, and maybe slipping over the brink into some sort of inner hell, because there's a terrible jangling sort of quality to it. And yet still, at that time, he was able to produce the Ninth Symphony. The Ninth Symphony.
Well, see, I'm very conscious when I was, you know, thinking about this before, you know, while listening to Tam O'Shanter, I said, now, try to hold yourself in check. Try not to say, this is noise, because this is, of course, exactly what people said of the Seventh Symphony. They said, this is just noise. I mean, obviously, the famous slow movement, and we, you know, there's such beauty in this. But there's a lot of very strange elements going on in it that we love now, but was completely dismissed at the time. And they're going, this is madness. It's just noise. It's just typing. And quite late, because obviously he's extraordinarily famous, and really it was to be saying that this was rubbish was quite strange, or to be even questioning that it wasn't pure genius, because he was at, you know, he was at a peak of creativity. But people were beginning to get worried by this movement and this noise that they were hearing in the Seventh.
Another thing, Tomas, even leaving aside, you know, the fact that he really changed music, acted as a bridge from one era into the next, he also had a foot in each camp when it came to how he set about his work. I mean, back in, you know, with Bach and Mozart, they were employed, and not just the pair of them, but there were court composers. There were, you know, Bach was a church composer, Mozart was at the court of Salzburg early in his career, and they were little better than servants. I mean, they weren't acknowledged as great, you know, the geniuses we would call them today. Whereas Beethoven moved away from that later in his career. He had wealthy patrons who gave him a stipend, but they didn't insist that he compose on a weekly basis the way Bach had to, you know. And it just reminded me a little bit of, it was a bit like back to the days when there was a maximum wage for footballers, and eventually they broke out of that. I mean, that's the situation Bach and Mozart were in, geniuses, but they were paid just as servants.
Right, and what, so that Beethoven is the man who broke out of this maximum wage mould? What, he's George Best?
Well, maybe they were both big drinkers.
No, I can't think of him as George Best. I mean, is there a footballer now that he you know, has great soul, is really passionate about the kind of whole business, but he's not interested in money? That's what we really need. So who would that be? Oh, that silence speaks a lot, doesn't it? Let's go and listen to Beethoven.
Yes, exactly.
A man with soul.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the final call. All doors are now closing, and we request that you take your seats in the auditorium immediately. Final call, ladies and gentlemen, all doors are now closing. Thank you.